able to introduce to you someone that I've known for a while. I've known her longer than she's known me. She is one of the employees at the World Service Office. Her name is Margaret O.B., and she is your archivist. It's a job which I have in West Virginia, and one which I'm very happy to have someone here to talk about their life. I asked her what I could say about her, and she said that she's a member of Al-Anon.
Thank you, Jackie. thank you, everybody. I want to thank all of the West Virginia Al-Anons who invited me here. You all had a part in it. I want to thank especially the committee and Marie and Rita for picking me up at the airport. And for Carolyn, who brought me to the choice of my, at the church of my choice yesterday evening, only to find out that she has a daughter living in my neighborhood in New York City, and that I'm just quite certain we belong to the same church in New York City. So is not my higher power with me? My heart is going a little pitter-patter, but I'm not too bad, I'm happy to say. I'm thinking back to Margaret D., our first forum editor, who always said, Al-Anons and AAs are wonderful. Even if you make a lousy speech, they still applaud. I don't know if she said lousy, but that was the thought anyway. I loved your logo when I received the flyer to fill out just as a formality. And it said, Stairway to Freedom. It just threw me back to the many doors that are open for people to step into Al-Anon. And I also thought how I stumbled into the doorway of Al-Anon and crawled up the 12 steps. I also, the theme, Stairway to Freedom, brought to mind the personal freedom I learned in Al-Anon and the freedom of choice. Those were my initial thoughts the minute I received that flyer. As the last speaker for this weekend, you never know if you like to be first or last. I still haven't made up my mind. But this weekend, I'm fortunate because of all the speakers that went before me. And I can tell you, folks, that my heart is very filled this morning. And I am a different person leaving today than I was when I arrived on Friday. Okay, I think I'll start backwards and tell you where I am today. Hopefully, I'm where my head is where my feet are. This is where I want to be. I want to be here so sincerely. I hope I can touch one person, as so many have touched me this weekend. I forget what night it was. First it began with Nell. I don't know if Nell's here. Nell gave me the courage to tell you that I abused the alcoholic. Not my husband, but my mother. Now, I have never said this before as large a crowd as this. And that, tells me that I'm getting more honest with myself in Al-Anon, and this is the name of the game for me. And how I identified with Father Leo when he told me, I can't take on the pain of anyone else. And I'm trying to keep that in mind all the time. The beautiful Alateen, who shared her story so honestly, brought out the honesty of the program. And in Blanche's talk and the many things she gave to me, she also gave me permission to read my notes. Thanks, Blanche. And I say that really, and I do have, you know, my story in quotes down, because one part of me says it's my age, you know, and I could ramble and forget very easily. But another part of me is that my story is of another time and another space and of another girl. And I'm not that girl today, but I don't want to forget that girl neither. I didn't say I am a very grateful, still recovering member of Al-Anon. I go to meetings in New York City, and I happen to work at the World Service Office. You would think that when I stumbled in the door of Al-Anon in 1971, that I kind of had it all together on the surface. After all, it was 5 years prior in 1966 that my husband had abandoned me and our three children. And I've looked, you know, when I said that word before, I've looked for a kinder word, a nicer word, but that's the reality. He abandoned his wife and three children. And the following year, my mother, one of the alcoholics in my life, had died. So, you know, in 1971, these people were out of my life, and I should be okay, right? I was sinking deeper and deeper into despair, confusion. I didn't know what was wrong with me. But let me go back still further and tell you a little bit about myself. I was a child of the Depression. I was the oldest girl of five children. I had two brothers and two sisters, and we knew hunger and deprivation. And before I was 8 years of age, I had heard the words drink, drunk, and binge, but I didn't know what they meant. When I was 8 years of age, my father, who was just a vague shadow in my memory, he lived at home. I mean, who divorced in those days, you know? But I have no memory whatsoever of my father, except that he died when I was 8 years of age. Again, I heard the words, and he was 35 years of age. Again, I heard the words, drink, drunk, binge, and also Bellevue Hospital, which is a large city hospital in New York City. My mother was a widow at age 28. With five children. At that time, they gave a widow's pension, they called it, which was welfare, but that's what they called it, widow's pension. And we lived in a neighborhood on the west side of New York City, on the just beginnings of Greenwich Village on the west side, which is now fashionable. But at that time, it was a neighborhood of dock workers and teamsters, and drunken brawls were very frequent. After my father died, an uncle came to live with us. He was my father's brother. And when I thought about it later, he was probably thrown out of his home by his mother and sisters. He wasn't married, never married, as far as I knew. But he came to live with us. Money was always scarce, and food and so forth. But when there was some sort of money, like the beginning of the month, when the checks arrived and everything, there was always some for rushing the growler. Now, for you younger people, that means you take the pitcher or the pail up to the corner saloon and get it filled up with beer for whatever, 25 cents or 50 cents, whatever it cost at that time. And if that didn't happen in our apartment, it happened in someone's apartment in the building, in the neighbors or something. So a fear dominated a large part of my childhood. Fear of my teachers, fear of the bill collectors, fear of the welfare investigator that would come unannounced to check up on us. They don't do that today. That's what they did years ago. Fear of the arguments and fear of violence. A broken front tooth and a scar above the upper lip was hard to explain as an accident when one's in the eighth grade. And let me tell you, the violence, that violence was one time, one chop that hit its mark with a wooden hanger. The uncle that lived with us disappeared for a while and was hiding out because he was wanted by the police as a result of a drunken brawl where someone was critically injured. He was caught and served some time in jail, and he returned to us. Then my memory is just that he was hauled away from our fire escape again by Bellevue Hospital attendants who came in an ambulance. He had a knife and he was hallucinating. I daydreamed that I would marry and be taken away from all this and vowed there would never be any arguments in my home or around my children. I didn't go out with many boys in my younger years. In fact, I was always amazed when some paid attention to me. I was tall for my age and reached my full height at 12 years of age. And the boys were always shorter than I was. I remember when I was 16, in a time when children were, when 16-year-olds were still children, and I had a crush on one of the boys. His name was Joe. And we had this tremendous snowstorm in the city. And he pelted me with snowballs and threw me down in the snow. And I felt so good and so happy. I remember saying to myself when I got up, he likes me. So that will give you a little idea of where I was coming from as far as my self-esteem was concerned. I met my knight in shining armor when I was 18, and he was just 18. Oh, it disturbed me so much. I think I was 7 months older than him. John, he was the high school hero. I had already graduated at age 17, and in those days, there was no thought of going to college, even though I had received a state regents diploma. I never heard the word scholarship before in those days. My older brother joined the Navy at 17, so it was up to me to work to help the family. When a child reached the age of 16 in those days, they were taken off the welfare rolls and expected to go out and help the family. So my soon-to-be husband had dropped out of high school for a year, but I guess he couldn't get anywhere fast, So he went back to high school because he wanted an athletic scholarship to college. And my girlfriends, who were, you know, maybe a year younger than I was or whatever, you know, they'd say, "Oh, Johnny, 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 you know, this and that." And I said, "Who's Johnny?" You know, when I had first met him. So he was the high school hero, and everybody had a crush on him. Well, John took a fancy to me for some reason. And he did graduate in the blaze of athletic glory, and the college offers came. But because of his grades, he had to spend a year at a junior college in Modesto, California. At this time, I was stricken with tuberculosis. Again, Bellevue Hospital. I spent a year in the hospital, flat on my back, literally flat on my back. I always obeyed the rules in those days. And I was a guinea pig, as many were in those days, for a new drug called streptomycin, followed by another year at home. When I was stricken with the tuberculosis, it was, you know, I like to think today, in a more romantic era, would have been called consumption, like Camille had. I had the galloping kind, like, you know, just the kind that came on very swift and very rapid. So I was in Bellevue Hospital at this time, and you know, you have inklings. Hindsight is wonderful. And I expected John to visit me. We were going steady. And I expected John to visit me at the hospital. But his younger sister came that evening to tell me, "Well, John's in California. He got the offer for the scholarship at Modesto." So off he went. And that's how I heard he went to Modesto, California. And I'd lay on my back and look at Life magazines, you know, the old Life magazine that was larger than it is today, with the beautiful California Golden Girls on the cover, and I'd wonder what John was up to. But the fact that he'd come home in the summertime and we'd pick up where we left off, he'd profess his love, and the fact that he still liked me, despite, you know, that I had this dread disease, you know, that really amazed me. So in between semesters, he would come home, profess his love, but be off again. He went off to the Catskill Mountains, what they call the Borscht Circuit. I can't say it very well. The Borscht Circuit, where he played basketball in that circuit throughout the Catskill Mountains. The different hotels would have teams, and that was the nucleus of some of the professional stars that came up through the ranks. So years of courtship were actually several months of togetherness. And you know, you think back and you say, did he ever really ask me to marry him? You know, it was just taken for granted. You go steady in those days and, you know, well, it's a couple of years, so when are you getting the engagement ring? You know, that was kind of the thinking at that time. But at any rate, we married. And whatever individuality I had became an extension of his. I lived in his shadow. We moved west to Colorado, where at that time he was a junior in college. He had a long college career. That was my first time out of New York City to go to Fort Collins, Colorado. The first day we arrived there, there was, of course, a job waiting for me. He was still the athletic star and had received many awards. At the end of this semester, John learned he was no longer eligible to continue playing ball but could remain in school without the scholarships or any financial aid whatsoever. It's not like it is today, or that when supposedly it is today, you know, when you read about it in the paper. Since I was working, I felt we could manage until he graduated. But his basketball career was his first love, and he didn't want to give it up. And his mother never forgave me, you know. She said I was the reason, you know, for his leaving school. And another sign back then, you know, when we moved to Colorado, was an early sign too. He had a huge dental bill, which his mother thought she sent the money for, but he still had this big bill. So when school broke that year, after he learned that he wouldn't be eligible anymore, we came back to New York City with the intention of returning to Colorado, settling into a job which was offered to him that would also allow him to continue playing basketball for the company he worked for in the AAU League. At the end of the summer, his job offer was not up to his expectations. I became pregnant with our first child, so we stayed in New York City, living in an apartment with his mother, her second husband, a daughter, and a grandfather, and me and my husband. After my daughter Mary Ann was born, we found an apartment in the same building, two floors below. At this time, John was a taxi driver and trying out for professional basketball teams. He had that always, he had that syndrome, always almost made it. You know, he went to the Pistons and the Knickerbockers and several teams like that, and he did go to camp and so forth, and then was the last man to be let go. Long absences away from home in pursuit of his impossible dream became a way of life for us. Signs of his extreme emotional behavior came to the surface when I was pregnant with my second child. I remember receiving a phone call from his boss, who was then a used car dealer, that if John didn't get the check into his hands that night, he would be calling the district attorney in the morning. Well, I remember that so clearly. It was winter time, we had a snowfall. And after I got that phone call, apparently I knew John was on his way home. I had a baby, Mary Ann, that I must have put up in my mother-in-law's, I can't remember, put on my short coat and boots and ran up to 3rd Avenue and 21st Street and waited on the corner for John to intercept him and tell him I received the phone call and let's run away. Now, I hope I would go back for Mary Ann. I'm sure I would. But from that moment on, it came from all over, the debts, the creditors, the lies, the staying away for days at a time, only to return as if nothing happened. The arguments, the twisting of the reality, the shock of not really having known the man that I married. I was beginning to doubt my own sanity. Talk about insanity. One period when I had only two children, I took a part-time job in a bank. Each day I loaded them up in the carriage and walked completely cross town to the alcoholic home I had left to my sick mother to care for them during the day. And after work, I'd go and pick them up, walk cross town again, and continue with my home responsibilities, only to have my husband meet me on payday and talk me into handing my pay over to him. Eviction notices, electricity shut off, washing machine repossessed. I really welcomed when the telephone was taken out because that was one way bad news couldn't reach me. I had to depend heavily on my in-laws for food with the admonishment to keep the dirty linen at home and tell no one your business. I tried keeping everything from my mother and brother, who was a bachelor living with my mother, who were both actively drinking. My other brother and two sisters were married and had families of their own. I always felt very alone and frightened. John, when he was at home, we tried family counseling, family court, psychologists, and another sign showed up. I remember a session with the psychologist and about his absences, and the psychologist said, if I didn't see or have contact with my wife and children every day, I would die. And John just said, no, you wouldn't. Another sign. At this point, I had the feeling I must be doing something wrong. I made an appointment at the clinic with a psychiatrist, but I canceled out at the last minute. I was just too frightened. You know, again, we didn't do those things in those days. And you can be very alone in a very big city. My husband lost one job after another, from coaching a top New York college freshman team, to salesman, to taxi driver. The broken promises, the waiting at the window, I began to look like Jane in the cartoon booklet, Jane's husband drinks too much. I wore clothes just to be covered, hand-me-downs that didn't fit and I didn't care. I wore black opaque stockings before they were in style. I walked with my head down. I tried to sell the carriage my baby was in, just to pay a debt. I felt like my nerves were on the outside of my skin rather than on the inside. I always wanted to be somewhere else other than where I was at that particular time, whether it be at home or in the park. My one big fear was that I would be hauled away in a straitjacket in front of my three children. Yes, I had another child. When the children were 7, 5 1/2, and 1 1/2 years old, rather than face a charge of embezzlement, John fled without a word, leaving me to find out from others what he had done. There was no communication whatsoever during this time. I had to seek welfare assistance, and the return of my childhood fears became very prominent again. 3 years later, I was called to the phone of my in-laws to hear his voice at the other end. What do you think, folks? To sum up, I took him back. Because despite everything that happened, I still held on to the dream that the family unit was best for the children. Remember, neither of us had a program, so we floundered a few more years. But the trust that I came into the marriage with was long gone. During this period, I had a part-time job in the rectory near where I lived, which enabled me to always be on hand for the children when they came home from school. We tried paying back a little of his debts in order to avoid prosecution. At this point, John was a carny in a carnival in the warmer months, and also worked for a messenger service in the winter time. And then one day in May of 1966, the day before the Memorial Day weekend, as I recall, and also a payday, as I recall, John left to go to work and never returned. And I have never seen him since. When I went to the police this time, as I have in the past, I was told, "Lady, he's not missing. He's just gone." So just when I and the children were picking up the pieces again and settling into some so-called normal existence, a letter would arrive. No return address, just some out-of-date postmark, out-of-state postmark. He was working at carnivals again. Some letters contained money, $100 at most. But to me, those letters said, "I'm still alive, I'm still your husband and the father of your children." One of the letters admitted he knew he had some serious problems and was going to do something about it. another letter that he sent to my son, which I didn't give my son at the time. I think he was 12 years of age, and I opened it and read it. He had been in jail because he was in a stolen car that, you know, someone else, he didn't know, whatever. Some story. And years later, although I kept the letter and his letters, I forgot about it, you know, and my son asked to read his letters one day, and I gave them to him, and we really had to patch up a rift. He thought I kept things from him, and I explained why I did, and so forth. I thought it was best at the time. So a good part of the 16 years of my married life was a blur. Obsessed with my husband's behavior and how I reared three children with some semblance of sanity amazes me. But I'm the scars they bear, and who knows how deep they are. Only they know that. When they were growing up and wondering where their father was, my stock answer was, he's on the road. According to me, he was the most travel salesman in the world. Later, my son did comment he learned more about his father from scrapbooks and letters that by some miracle, I had the presence of mind to keep. I withdrew from my family and friends. My mother died the following year, as I mentioned, after he left as a result of alcoholism. My brother at the time was in an alcoholic fog. I shifted my obsession from my husband to my children. I existed for them. I say existed, for it was not living. I was a robot, automatically doing only the things I had to do. I was fearful of going out of the little square where I existed. Still working at the rectory, I felt safe, but admitted to myself that I was hiding out. My self-esteem kept going down and down. I felt the whole world knew more about my husband than I did. I felt I was three persons, giving each of my children one of me. They suffered because of my fears and my bitterness. I had decided that as long as I was going to be the only parent they had, I would be the perfect parent. On one hand, a strict disciplinarian, looking only for A's in school and having it known that my way was the best way. I was so overwhelmed by my morbid sense of responsibility that in reality, it often left me unable to deal with many situations. My oldest daughter spearheaded her entry into one of the finest colleges by way of scholarship without any help from me. I was totally inadequate in many areas. If any of you have ever read the book, Diary of a Mad Housewife, you might remember the beginning of the book. It was devoted to all the main characters' fears. They ran down the whole page. Fear of getting up in the morning, fear of going to bed at night, fear of heights, fear of subways, fear of riding in the car. As I read it, I identified with all those fears and more. The decision to leave the rectory was made for me when a new pastor was appointed and he brought his own staff with him. This was my chance to venture out, but still I hesitated, overcome with fear and low self-esteem. So this was the state I was in when in June of 1971, I received a phone call from a friend that lived up the street to tell me there was an opening at the place where she was working for a clerk typist at minimum wage. I was still on getting a supplementary welfare wage. My first question to her was, what floor was the office on? Because you see, I couldn't ride an elevator or go beyond the second floor. She said the eighth floor. She also said, if I was interested, I better get over there fast. Well, putting food on the table for three kids was stronger than my fears. And trying not to think about it, I walked over to 115 East 23rd Street.
And that was an added incentive. I didn't have to get on a bus or a subway, and best of all, I didn't have to spend car fare. The organization was the Al-Anon Family Group Headquarters Incorporated. There, a wonderful office supervisor, Henny Niger, she was not a member, but she had a lot of Al-Anon. She hired me as a clerk typist in the group records department. Although I was trained as a secretary, I readily accepted the job, saying to myself, I talk to myself a lot, just till I get on my feet and I'll look for something better. I had never heard of Al-Anon or any other Anon for that matter. During the interview, when a little of my personal situation came out, Henny said, they have a meeting here on Thursdays at lunchtime. I think you should go to it. Well, of course I went, because in those days I did everything I was told to do. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting that first Thursday, and around that table there were, among others, as I recall, Henrietta, Holly, both deceased, Evelyn, Timmy, and Helen, who are now retired, and Myrna. When I came out of the meeting, I said to myself, boy, are those women crazy. Talking so openly about their lives. Who wants to bring up all that stuff? I want to forget my past, bury it in some corner. But one thing lingered in my mind, again saying to myself, they can't be all that bad. They have a spiritual side. For I realized long before that someone, somewhere, some force had kept me alive, because I had many, many times no desire to go on living. Only the one thought that my three children would have no one to take care of them kept me going. And it was that power, whom I call God, got me through each day. At the office, I was surprised that everyone was called by their first name. Even the executive director, general secretary, and that everyone ate at the same lunch table, and that when coffee, mayonnaise, and tea bags were on sale, Henrietta and others would bring them in from their local supermarkets. I was impressed by the integrity of the people, and that every dime was accounted for and every letter was answered. I was a little skeptical about self-support. Said it'll never last. And I needed my pay every week. Shortly after I was employed, we were deluged by thousands of individual inquiries in response to an Ann Landers column. Everybody pitched in. At that time, there might have been 20 some odd employees. Many of us took letters home so that they could be answered as quickly as possible. I received so much joy knowing I could help someone in this way, because I had never received help when I needed it. Often I would actually picture the person going to the mailbox in some country, remote place, and going to their box out at the curb and getting my letter, giving them help. I was in group records for only about 2 weeks when I became Henrietta's secretary, and remained so up till her retirement, or shortly before that. In January 1976, since Henny, the office supervisor, was retiring, that position was offered to me. So Henrietta was retiring shortly after that, so I accepted. I held that job for about 2.5 years and was wonderful at it. Everybody said so, but I hated it. I wasn't too happy in that position, hiring and firing. And essentially, it was all business, and outside the program. And I was enmeshed in the program by this time, still attending the Thursday meetings and meetings outside as well. In 1978, when it became known that an archivist would soon be needed, I began dropping hints that I would like to be considered. As you know, an archivist is a fancy name for keeping the history. But having the privilege of having known Lois and Anne, Margaret D., Alice B., all those wonderful pioneers, and under the guidance of Henrietta, I grew to love and know the organization and love the program, which was nurtured in me by these wonderful people. And remembering my son's remarks that he had learned more about his father through the things I had saved, I knew the importance of collecting and organizing the early history of Al-Anon. But going back to my new life in Al-Anon, when I stumbled through that door, it began with the first leaflet handed to me, which was just for today, and I still use it today. Knowing that I only had to live one day at a time lifted a weight that I had carried around for about 20 years. I started simply with the slogans, easy does it, what do you think I got on here? And I didn't even pick it out. Easy does it, live and let live. I detached with love and gave my kids a break. And today we're best friends. I remember the first time that, you know, you kind of go back and say, when was the first time I caught on to like a principle in Al-Anon? And I think the detachment came when one Sunday I was preparing a big Thanksgiving type dinner for us, you know, big roast and all the trimmings. And my teenage son at the time, when I was just about ready to serve dinner, went to the door and said, I'll see you later. And I said, okay, from a hot kitchen. But I said, okay. Well, he made an about face and he came back and he said, boy, have you changed? He was just trying to get a reaction from me. So it was simply changing the way I was doing things I had done in the past, which would probably run after him, grab him by his collar, and pull him bodily back to the table. I was slow to learn, slow to change a lifetime of habit, but little by little, Al-Anon does seep in, even before you are aware of it. A new and different world was unfolding before me, and I loved it. I learned that alcoholism is a disease, and then I dealt with the deep-seated guilt that I felt toward family members that had suffered, and some suffering still, and whom I loved dearly. When I was getting a little better, I had decided I was ready to forgive my husband, a little bit. And I was to chair my first Al-Anon meeting. So I chose the subject of forgiveness. And I went through the ODAT book and I wondered why they only had one page devoted to forgiveness. And that really puzzled me. But anyway, that's the page I brought to the meeting, and I chaired the meeting on forgiveness. And I had an eye-opener that day. It was a good meeting and good discussion. But you told me I had no right to forgive because then I had judged. Instead, you told me to put the focus on myself and to forgive myself. Forgive myself, you know. I mean, the language, you know, when you first knew an Al-Anon, we do speak a strange language, you know. I didn't know what individuality meant. I mean, for me personally, you know, I knew the word, but like my individuality, I was always attached to somebody. I was always a daughter. I was always a sister. I was always a wife, always a mother. So I couldn't grasp that so quickly. But I'm learning to forgive myself more and more each day. So when you told me to do that, I began to feel the bitterness that I felt for my husband leave. And today I have turned him over and have given him back to God. I don't know whether he's dead or alive today, but I do pray for that man every day. And I can do that with a free and sincere heart. You told me to accept and that I had control over no one but myself and that things and people may not change, but I can change my attitude toward them. You told me that I did not have to be perfect and that if I slip back to the old patterns or fail in a new experience, that's okay too, because I'll pick myself up and try again, knowing that I'm not alone and I'll never be alone again. There are many examples of my new Al-Anon way of life, and some numerous and varied. But one at the beginning stands out in my mind when my oldest daughter, my first daughter, was being married in July of 1975. Despite the fact there was no husband, there was no father to walk down the aisle, despite the fact that one brother was absent due to alcoholism, and despite the fact that another brother and a brother-in-law had a fist fight in the parking lot after the wedding, despite the fact that I was facing surgery right after the wedding, I felt it was the most beautiful days of my life because you told me I could make up my mind to be happy, and that is exactly what I did. And in my memory, it was the most glorious day. And I faced the surgery shortly after with a calm I had never known before, despite the fact that we didn't know the outcome, which turned out to be good as well. Incidentally, my youngest daughter was married several years later, and my two brothers, the one who was absent at my first daughter's wedding, and the other who was having the drunken brawl, were both at Nancy's wedding, happily sober, looking at everyone else making a fool of themselves. And me and my brothers have never been closer. I went to a meeting not too long ago and the topic was goals. I didn't think I ever had any goal other than to be a good wife and a good mother. But as the meeting progressed, I realized my goals in Al-Anon were quite different. First, to get through the day without the heavy weight on my chest. Next, a goal to have peace of mind. After a while, I made them a little more materialistic, like completing my first year of work, and with vacation pay, I bought a new refrigerator, which had more freezing space, thereby eliminating my going to the supermarket every day for something for supper that night. Did you ever hug and kiss the refrigerator? I loved it. The second year when I received my vacation money, it was a new armchair. The third year, a TV set. After that, small bus trips with my youngest child to Amish country in Pennsylvania and to Washington, D.C. I began to see my doctor and dentist regularly. I joined a health club. I learned how to be good to me. I had never flown an airplane till 1980 when I went to the International Convention in New Orleans. I thank Al-Anon for that too. What would I do today, having a daughter and two grandchildren in North Carolina? Around 1976, I decided to do something about my marriage status. Every year when I would fill out my income tax, and you would have to check off the box if you were single or married or unmarried head of household. I would get such a resentment because I felt I was not married for many years, yet I had not gotten a formal divorce. And I couldn't be considered single. An unmarried head of a household really blew my top. So for the first time in my life, I went to see a lawyer. In my ignorance, I thought I would be able to declare my husband dead. Since I had not seen him at this point for 10 years and had not received a letter from him in 7 years, I thought I could have the respectable title of widow. The lawyer was very pleasant. And he said, "And what will you call yourself when he comes back?" He said I had to have proof that my husband was dead. And he was willing to give me help with getting a divorce. But I had Al and I by this time now, you know. So I felt I could have gotten a divorce many years before. And this did not satisfy me at this time. Instead, I went to my church's tribunal and stated my case. And they, too, directed me back to a civil lawyer to get my civil divorce first. But I felt differently. I had waited so long and was in no hurry, so I requested that they proceed with my church annulment first. 2 years later, I received my annulment from the Archdiocese of New York City. No easy feat. And shortly thereafter, I received my civil divorce. I didn't even have to appear in court. But you know, there was no shouting from the rooftops. For me, the emotional divorce from my husband was achieved through Al-Anon. And it was what I had felt inside. I didn't even tell relatives for the longest time, and I kept it from his own mother. She was aging, and it would have added fuel to the fire. Maybe I was still fearful of her, too, at that time. But the emotional release that I had through Al-Anon was my victory and my divorce. To me, the beauty of the Al-Anon program is that it applies to life in general. It helps you stand firm in any emergency, meanwhile gaining a new appreciation for life's joys. Al-Anon has shown me it is not important what happens in my life, but how I deal with the happenings, how I meet whatever comes my way. I have stopped my childish fantasies and dreams of escape. When Al-Anon directed me to an orderly, meaningful life and showed me how to attain it and keep it, at last I began to mature instead of being overwhelmed by fears and ghosts of the past. Life does begin at 40. It did for me at 44. Instead of the pleading, begging relationship that I had with my higher power, today I have a loving relationship with my higher power that I am so grateful for. Today I ask for guidance and pray that I will be a better person today than I was yesterday, and that I will meet each day's challenges in a sane manner. And when I take the 10th step every night and review the day and see that I have done the best I can, I am at peace. Oh, how the pieces of the puzzle of my life all center around why I found Al-Anon and why my higher power led me through that door. I really used to be paranoid about how my children were living their lives, but Al-Anon helps me, and that each morning I not only take a third step for myself, but a third step for my children. knowing that they have a God of their understanding looking out for them too. I have a wonderful sponsor, and I like phrases and little quick fixes, you know. And one that I have, I was telling her an incident with my daughter and son-in-law, and she said, "Don't get in between two people who share the same pillow." And that's what I try to keep in mind today, dealing with my daughter, my son, my daughter-in-law, and my son-in-laws. And it helps. You know, I just wanted to say, too, I thought about Lois a lot this weekend, too. And I had the privilege of being at her memorial service. And there the minister spoke about Bill and Lois and the good they did. And he said that their prayer and the prayer of the fellowship is, "Give me, help me, use me." I've seen a lot of that here this weekend. My sister died in 1982, cirrhosis of the liver. Her husband, a couple of years after that, another victim of alcoholism. Do you know, I could get very depressed with the history of the alcoholism in my family, in my life, but I'm encouraged today, despite it all, because I feel this generation, at least, has broken the pattern, and that there are people in recovery today in my family and both fellowships of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful. My higher power today is a heartbeat away. It's with me always, just a heartbeat away, a blink of an eye away. I know he's right there with me all the time and has been all along. I told you where I am today. I don't know where I'm going. I feel this weekend I've reached another plateau. The wonderful sharings that I've had, the feelings feelings again at the workshops that I attended. I mean, I couldn't speak afterwards. I was so filled up. And I am going back with lots of gifts. And I thank you all for it. I'd just like to close with a favorite quote of mine, which is, "The older I grow and the more I abandon myself to God's will, the less I value intelligence that wants to know and will that wants to do. And as the only element of salvation, I recognize faith, which can wait patiently without asking too many questions. I try to keep it simple. I don't analyze, I utilize. And I want to thank you for loving me in a very special way, even though you don't know me. Thank you."